Okay, I think we're ready to go now. So let's do the Namo Tassa first. You can all join in with me if you wish. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang Dhammang Sangkhang Namassami. So, I think the last time I did the sutta class was in the beginning of January. And in those meantime, Ajahn Bhumali has chosen sutras. But what I have been doing, as many of you will remember, was taking a famous work called The Word of the Buddha, which was an anthology of texts chosen by the German monk in Sri Lanka, who passed away a long time ago now, Venerable Jnana Tiloka, and all based around the framework of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. This is core Buddhist teachings. And that was translated for, I don't know how many years ago now, so I thought it was time for an upgrade of the translation, and so this is a new, modern translation. And because there's many versions of this, that's why we have to make sure the one I have in front of me is the one you see on the screen there. So far, we talked about the first noble truth, the second noble truth. Now we get to the third noble truth. It's not like we're halfway through, because the fourth noble truth of the path, the Eightfold Path, that takes up the majority of this work. So we've still got a long way to go on this. So I'm glad that we got the right documents on the machine there. Can you all see it okay? Good. So the noble truth... Oops. Anyone cannot... I mean, there's one other way of making it bigger is go closer. So you can actually get a telescope. That's one of Ajahn Chah's great teachings. This fellow was walking in the forest and he found a hole in the ground. There was a huge treasure in the bottom of the ground. But he tried to reach the treasure, but the hole was too deep. He stretched and stretched and he couldn't get to the treasure. And then he sort of saw another man, there's a big treasure in the hole, but it's too deep. My hand can't reach it. And the man told him, said, you're seeing things the wrong way. It's not the hole's too deep, your arm is too short. So the man extended his arm by picking up a stick and hooking the treasure out. Always like that, similarly. It's not the hole is too deep, your arm is too short. So lengthen the arm, problem solved. Anyway, here we go. Now this is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting. And the wanting we're referring to is wanting relating to the five senses, anything to do with seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, wanting to exist, the wanting to be, and the wanting for annihilation. That's the thinking that one is, that one will sort of destroy the self. And that wanting for annihilation, as I mentioned last time, that when you examine it and see it, you can see why it is a craving. It never works, because an I cannot destroy an I. In quoting from Oliver Twist, it's like a man who decides he wants to eat his own head. You can say that, to eat your own head, but a little consideration will soon show you it's impossible to do. So wanting to annihilate yourself is like trying to eat your own head. The giving up and relinquishing of that wanting, freedom from it, never letting it settle. And many of you may recognize those as the four ways of letting go. It's giving up, relinquishing it, the freedom from it. In other words, you're happy to be here, so you don't want anything. And you're never letting things settle. Wherever in the world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there the cessation of wanting comes about. This is similar to said, where does craving or wanting come? Where there's agreeable and pleasurable things. So you don't overcome suffering and the wanting which causes suffering by just moving totally away, you know, from the body and the world. You can only move away so far. You can simplify, but you cannot just disappear in that particular way. You have to cease the wanting right in the middle of the five or the six senses. There the cessation of wanting comes about. And what is there in the world that is agreeable and pleasurable? Sight in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. Hearing, smell, taste, touch and knowing is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting comes to be abandoned. There its cessation comes about. And it's one of those fine points of insight to realize that even though you know that seeing, for example, the first of those senses, is sometimes delightful, sometimes you see ugly things. But underneath the content, or beside the what you see, the very act of seeing is a delight. You want to see, first and foremost, and secondly, you'd rather see pleasurable things rather than ugly things. It is the craving, the wanting to exist, to experience the world, to sense. So the two types of wanting for seeing is not just wanting pleasurable stuff, it's just wanting to see. Whatever spiritual seekers in the past regarded pleasant and agreeable things in the world as impermanent, as suffering, as non-self, as a disease, as fearful, they abandoned wanting. So this gives one of the reasons why we abandon wanting, because anything which is pleasant and agreeable, number one, it's impermanent, it's out of control. In other words, it's going to change and disappear by itself, in spite of you, irrespective of what you want, totally disregarding your agenda. Things come and go according to their nature, not according to your scheduling. And pleasant and agreeable as suffering, and the reason for that is the more pleasurable it is, it will soon vanish and disappear. The more pleasurable it was, the more suffering you have afterwards. And as non-self means it doesn't belong to you anyway. That's one of the reasons why you can't control it. If you owned your car, you could do with it as you wished. But if you're just renting it, you have to return it in a good shape as when you got it. Otherwise you get fined. Because these things don't belong to you, you can't do with them as you wish. And as a disease, there is one of the favorite sayings that if anyone ever asks you what the meaning of life is, you can tell them, it's not in the Buddhist suttas, but it's very accurate, that life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. And if you think about that, that's pretty accurate. So, it is a disease. And whereas as fearful, oh, now that's amazing, fearful. People are afraid of the wrong things in life. People are afraid of peace and disappearing and deep meditation. That's why sometimes you get so far, I'm disappearing. I'm being happy. I'm becoming free. But we don't like that. We're afraid of the wrong things. I've just been editing one of the books coming out next. And of course, one of the items in that book is a famous story of the worm in the pile of dung. And his friend says, the dung is terrible. Come up to stay in heaven with me. Is there any dung up in heaven? Oh, no. well, can I take some with me? Because my dung is fragrant, it's warm, it's delicious, it's my food, because that's where a worm lives. So no. So the worm is afraid of being separated from its dung. That's our fear. We like our dung. We have great fun with that story. So as fearful, that we regard other stuff as fearful, and they abandoned wanting. Even wanting is fearful. Wanting, I said in this little book, it's a nice saying, the wanting is the distance between where you are and where you want to be. It's a nice little definition. The distance from where you are to where you want to be. That's called wanting, suffering. So if you're happy to be where you are, there's no distance between where you are and where you want to be. You don't want anything, there's no suffering. So the dependent cessation of all phenomena, and this is a great title because the all phenomena, this is not just what you experience, it's also the experiencer, the whole mechanism for which you experience and investigate and explore the world. It's not just what's out there, it's everything which is in here as well, ceasing. And how does this happen? Causes. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting, when you don't want anything, when you're still, you're content, happy, comes the cessation of the fuel. This is one of those translations of upadana. Usually people call it clinging. And sometimes that just does not really get to the heart of what that word means. It's much better to call it a fuel. It literally means, you know, the upa is exactly the same as the English word up. Many of those Pali words are equivalent to the words we have in English, because English is an Indo-Aryan root language. It's I don't know how it got from India, but it's got many, many Indian roots in English. And the Ardhana, the Upa Ardhana, you will all know, I hope, from the second precept. Adina Ardhana Veramani. Sikkhapadang Samadhiyami. Adina means not given. Ardhana, taking. Receiving. So upadana literally means taking up. And that's why it's used for the word fuel. A car takes up the petrol or the gas in the engine. An oil lamp takes up the oil. That's why it's called fuel. What something takes up in order to exist and grow. The trees take up water and other nutrients from the soil. It upadanas that water. So comes the cessation of fuel. When there's no water, there's nothing fuel. The gas has run out. When the cessation of that fuel, there's nothing to keep more states of existence growing. And this is, I always find this a fascinating part of the dependent origination. This idea of bhava, the existence, you know, how things actually grow, and how much the mind creates the world. Certainly in the realms of the hell realms, ghost realms, certainly the heaven realms, how much the mind creates those realms for you. We actually make existence. And even this realm we live in now, this human realm, yes, we have a language which makes us agree on many, many things. But if you actually talk to one another, we do live in separate worlds. One of the reasons why we argue. And we do actually create those worlds. We create more of this earth than many people believe. We are not just people who are living in this place with no input into the nature of this world. Huge input. We actually create states of existence because of our wanting, fueling the creation of these things. And of course, when there's no states of existence to be reborn into, cessation of rebirth. There's no place to get reborn. It's like the bird with no place where it can roost. It just flies through the air, never finding a twig or a branch or a wall in which it can stand. No place where it can land. It disappears. Aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, unhappiness and distress cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This is the passing away of suffering. There was, just going on a tangent here, that was one of the most important insights for my path, looking at dependent origination, in this case dependent cessation. That just that link, that cause, that rebirth is the cause of suffering. It wasn't that once you're reborn that you can actually do something about this, be wise, try and just be compassionate, get into jhanas, then you don't have any suffering. So know that rebirth is the cause. Once you're born, you're going to suffer. And it's not here, maybe it's in another quote here. This is the Bhikkhuni Wajira. I think it was her, in the Bhikkhuni Samyutta, where she was asked by this fellow Mara, what's it like being a bhikkhuni? And being an arahat, fully enlightened. And this was one of the most wonderful interviews. What does it feel like to be fully enlightened? And she answered, being fully enlightened is just suffering arising and suffering passing away. That's all. And of course that was another thing which really hit me. That's incredible. That's all that she saw. So what's the point of being fully enlightened? You still have suffering arising and suffering passing away. And the point is that when you die, then the suffering ceases without remainder. That's why it knows. That's why sometimes I ask people to actually test them, their knowledge of the Dhamma. Do enlightened beings suffer? And many people who don't know their Buddhism say, oh, of course not, they're enlightened, they're happy ever after. No. Enlightened beings suffer. In the Theragata, they describe it like a workman who's finished their job but hasn't been paid yet. A workman waiting for their wages. The check is in the mail. And the check comes at the Parinibbana, the end of the life. That's why, of all those four places of pilgrimage in India, Kusinara, to me, that is the big one. The place where the Buddha ended suffering. The causes of suffering were abolished at Bodh Gaya, under the Bodhi tree. But those causes never came to fruition. The check never arrived until he was in Kusinara. To me, that was a big one. So, and of course, we all talk about dependent origination, but how many people actually talk about dependent cessation? That's the important one. Dependent origination just causes suffering. We want to end suffering, so dependent cessation, much more important. So the cessation subsiding and passing away of form, experience, that's right, no, perception of will, of consciousness, is the cessation of suffering. The subsiding of disease, the passing away of aging and death. So that's what ceases. Just form, experience, perception, will, consciousness is. So not a person who passes away, just this process. Any questions? Okay, we get the microphone.
Bhante, so just following up from what you just said about enlightened beings, my understanding is that there's three sorts of suffering that we experience. One is just, you know, the hot and cold, the fact of being in the body and all that sort of stuff. The second form of suffering is the suffering of not getting what I want and having what I don't want. The third one is, which you're alluding to, the sense of self, the khandhas, the sense of cognizing a sense of self, and then the sheer grunt of
a being.
So is it fair to say that after someone is enlightened but still in the body, that those second and third ones fall away, but the first one doesn't fall away until you basically die?
Yeah, it's the word in Pali is dukkha dukkha, sankhara dukkha, viparinama dukkha. And not in that order, actually. The sankhara dukkha, the fact of existence, the things come, they're here, they arise, they pass away. That is a big one. Viparinama dukkha, that things always change. We can accept that. Things don't last. And dukkha dukkha is the ordinary common and garden version of dukkha, having to pay your taxes, looking at what goes on in the United States with politics. That's dukkha dukkha, that's ordinary stuff. This is the deeper stuff. Even when you get everything else out of the way, and everything else is happy, just the fact that you are to be is to suffer. You know that as a psychologist, you actually make your living out of that truth. To be is to suffer.
Yeah, we have this thing called a storyline. Yeah. And it's the story we tell ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
And then that just goes on and on and on in new situations, and we react to it. So I guess that's really what we're talking about when we talk about that sense of
it's just
being.
Just so deep, just to be. When you be, you have to take everything which comes. So you're never free.
Thank you.
So anyway, now we get more into this, because this is all about Nibbana. This is the end of suffering, the third noble truth. Nibbana with residue remaining. This is Sat-pari-sesa Nibbana. That's literally what it means, with something remaining. This is peaceful. This is sublime. That is the stilling of all will. This is the Sabba Sankara Samatha, of all will. The relinquishing of all acquisitions. Everything you let go of, not just physical stuff, your mental stuff as well. The destruction of wanting, fading away, cessation, nirvana. And earlier on in this, we said how the Buddha remarked under the Bodhi tree, just so few people will even understand what it means to still all the will. Sabba Sankara Samatha. Wow. That is really disappearing. Because there's something which happens, which I pointed out, when there is stillness, especially the stillness of the will, things vanish. You see me say this before, it's so well known, that when you close your eyes, you see the inside of your eyelids doesn't move, so after a while, the sense of sight turns off. Hearing, you can hear the sound of the traffic in the background. But after a while, it doesn't change that much. It disappears. It vanishes. Anything which is still disappears. That's why it says it fades away and then ceases. So when you still all of the sankhara, all of the will, things vanish. Everything disappears. Okay. Nibbana. Now, the next one, when excited by wanting, overcome by wanting, when full of aversion, overcome by aversion, when deluded, overcome by delusion, with the mind obsessed by these things, You intend for your own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both. You're experiencing mental suffering and depression. But when wanting, aversion, and delusion are abandoned, you don't want anything. We have no aversion to stuff. And delusion, you see, the driverless bus. There's no one driving that bus, so stop complaining. You do not intend for your own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both. You do not experience mental suffering and depression. It's actually because of these things of wanting and aversion and underlying delusion. That is actually why we cause so much affliction and irritation for one another. So for those people who really want to be compassionate, which means the lessening the affliction we cause one another, lessening the wars, the arguments, and all the problems we cause one another, we have to overcome our wanting, aversion, and delusion. Because when wanting, aversion, and delusion are abandoned, you don't intend for your own affliction. It's not just others' affliction, you afflict yourself. For the affliction of others or for the affliction of both, you do not experience mental suffering and depression. It is in this way that Nibbana is directly visible. This is the Nibbana with residue remaining, the Nibbana of affliction. It ceases. No more affliction. The destruction of wanting, the destruction of aversion, the destruction of delusion, this is called Nibbana with residue remaining. So you're perfectly peace, you don't need anything or want anything, no aversion, no one can upset you, and you have full understanding. Nibbana, these causes of wanting, aversion, delusion have been abandoned, ceased. That's with residue remaining. So what's remaining? No, sense of self is gone. What? The khandhas, yes, the components of existence. Your body is still there. When the Buddha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, he didn't just poof, vanish and become invisible. He still had his feeling, the experience, and the perceptions, the will, and the consciousnesses still appear to all other beings, to as a human being. But that remained. But the wanting, the aversion, and the delusion, that is what vanished. And the khandhas, the components of existence, that disappeared at Kusinara. So the arahat. If one is intent on the end of wanting, that's a nice little translation there. It didn't say if one wants the end of wanting, which is one of those oxymorons. You can't want the end of wanting. Otherwise that's more wanting. Or your intent or the end of wanting. And clarity of mind, it adds this here. Have you ever noticed the more you want, the more you tire the mind? The more the mind is exhausted, the less clear it becomes. But when you don't want anything, and still the clarity of the mind increases. When one is intent on the end of wanting and clarity of mind, when one sees the senses arising, one's mind is completely free from desire. See them arising, but they're not going to go anywhere. So you don't desire them, you don't want them, you don't try and control them. For one of peaceful mind, one completely liberated, there's nothing further to be done. No need to increase what has been done. They say this because sometimes, so this is the teaching of the Buddha, this is an accurate translation, just modernized, taking away much of the repetition. Some of the teachings afterwards, they, instead of having an arahat, they actually had this other alternative, not really an alternative, as a bodhisattva, and still every now and again you read people saying, and these are monks, but they haven't actually had good training, saying that if you are an arahat, fully enlightened, if you really work hard, you can go to the next stage and become a bodhisattva. That's what I've read several times, which is a lot of go mayang. And I think you understand Go Mayang now. If you don't understand Go Mayang, you can actually go back to one of the earlier talks here. In other words, he says very clearly here, and this is not just one place, many places, that for one a peaceful mind, one completely liberated, there's nothing further to be done. No need to increase what has been done. That's it. You've done. As a stone mountain, one solid mass is not stirred by the wind. So no sight, sound, odors, taste, touches or mind objects, desirable or undesirable, stir the stability of the mind. The mind is steady and freed, and you witness the vanishing of the mind. It's a nice little end statement there, the mind vanishing. And the stone mountain not stirred by the winds. That, if you can remember, this is not in the suttas, this is, I believe, in Tsung Po's works, of the monk who thought he was enlightened, staying on an island in the middle of the lake, and he sent a poem to his abbot to show he was enlightened. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And the abbot sort of wrote on those four lines, fart, 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 fart. And that really upset the monk. And the monk just went over the lake to see the abbot to complain. And the abbot said, ha, 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 you said that you're not moved by the four worldly winds, but four little farts have blown you clean across the lake. It's a very wonderful old story. And this is where it comes from. If you really are in line, you're a stone mountain, one solid mass, you're not stirred by the wind. Nothing actually moves you. So that's where he was coming from when he wrote that poem. Oh, you mean why the Buddha teaches? Okay, yeah, okay. What moves the Buddha? Yes, of course, no will, it's no self. So this is just interesting. It was Brahmasahampati, who, under the Bodhi tree, Sahampati in previous life was also a monk under Kassapa the Buddha, as Siddhartha Gautama in previous life was a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. There's three of them, is Gatikara, also a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. And those two, Gatikara and Sahampati, came to see their old mate, Siddhartha Gautama, former life Jyotipala, under the Bodhi tree. Congratulations, friend. You are now fully enlightened. And it was Sahampati who said, teach for the benefit of all beings. There are those with little dust in their eyes. They will understand the Dhamma. And sometimes people miss the importance of that conversation. That is what was the seed to motivate the Buddha's teaching career. So still that there's not even thought to teach. It's so perfectly still. You need that to come from outside, to be asked. Many what they call the Pacheka Buddhas, the silent Buddhas who don't teach at all. Why? Because no one asked. You need that input, that seed, to get it going. Can't do it from a self. There's no self left. So it was Brahmasahampati's fault. Now, you know, it comes from the Anagami. Well, sometimes I even call him in the translation, not a good translation, one of the gods from the Brahma realm. And so, one of the monks years ago, is a monk called Kantipala, not the Kantipala from Sydney, a Kantipala German monk. He once used to go around saying, and I like the saying, he said, thank God for Buddhism. Thank Sahampati for Buddhism. If he hadn't said that, we wouldn't be here today. It's a bit of a joke, I'm funny saying. He said, thank God, Brahmasahampati for Buddhism. If he hadn't have asked, it wouldn't have happened. So that was the seed. And from that seed, it just worked its way through with all of the actions from loving kindness as a sense of duty, not from what I want.
Do you think in spiritual life that is a process and a continual that one moves more and more into a different place of spiritual life, that one is motivated by the Brahmaviharas and less by...
Exactly. Because motivation from the Brahmaviharas is selfless. It's not coming from wanting. It's coming from letting go, from giving, from renouncing. Not what I want, what's needed. That's where it comes from. So yes, very much Brahmaviharas.
Do you feel that?
Feel that?
Do you feel that because you're a guide?
Yeah, of course. The last thing I wanted to do on a Sunday afternoon is be in front of you guys. But my loving kindness, oh yeah, sure, let's do this. Okay, I'm exaggerating there. Have you got a question? Okay. Yes, will and wanting, exactly. It all comes together. If there's no will, you don't want anything. Here we go. The Arahat. If one is in... Oh, I did that already. A stone mountain. So, and one who has considered all the contrasts in this earth. This is a nice one. One who has considered all the contrasts on this earth and who is no more disturbed by anything whatever in this world. The peaceful one, free from rage, from frustration, and from wanting, that stream of consciousness will not be reborn. I like that one. All the contrast in the self, as you consider it, yeah, you get old, you get young, you have a good day, a bad day, sometimes it rains, sometimes it gets hot, sometimes you're healthy, sometimes you're sick. It just goes round and round, you can't really control it, so you just let it be. You're not disturbed by anything in the world because you don't expect anything else. One of my sayings, based on obviously Buddhism, suffering is asking from the world something it can't give you. So you consider all the contrast, you know what this world gives you and what it can't give you, you don't ask for anything else. You don't expect anything else. And it takes away all the rage. Politicians, to think them to be wise and compassionate? If they're wise and compassionate, they're wise, they'll never become a politician. So all the stuff wise we got standing for us, you know, that's what they're like. So don't be disappointed. So when you understand what life can give you, then you're much more at peace with life. No rage. And free from frustration, from wanting. That's where from frustration comes from. Wanting too much. Wanting what the world can't get you. That's called frustration. So, I don't know what's happening over there in that little room over there, but I think they're getting very frustrated because they want something and they can't get it. Probably the internet's not working. That's considered all the contrast on this earth. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. This is where I was quoting earlier. Mara asks, says from the Samyutta Nikaya, by whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? Where has this being arisen? And where does this being cease? And the bhikkhuni. This just shows bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha, they were just really classy people. And so it's really, can't understand why we don't have bhikkhunis these days. Well, we're getting them now, need more. The bhikkhuni arahat vajira, one of the great sayings here. Why do you now assume a being, Mara? Is that your wrong view? This is a heap of sankharas. Here no being is found. Just as with coming together of parts, the word vehicle is used. So when the five components of existence exist, it's just a conventional term, a being. In the original it said chariot. We don't use chariots these days, so I'll put vehicle. I don't know why more people don't just up the translations we have these days. it is only dukkha, suffering, that comes to be. Dukkha that stands and dukkha that falls away. Nothing but dukkha comes to be. Nothing but dukkha ceases. Instead of saying, who created this world? Who's the maker of this? Just suffering arising, suffering passing away. That's all. Sometimes that's quite powerful. The end of suffering. Nibbana. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. So now, that's a powerful hitting one. Now we go to the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. There are these two extremes that should be avoided. The pursuit of happiness through the five senses, which is low, called hina, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial, and the opposite, the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and mind, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. This is from the Buddha's first teaching. This is the middle way. And I use the Pali word there, low, hina, because sometimes people call Theravada hina-yana. And sometimes they explain, oh, that just means the small vehicle. It does not mean small. It means low, inferior, yucky, mean, rotten. It's a very bad word. It's actually insulting. So anyway, but it's used here to when you really indulge in the five senses. And the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and mind, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. And that is accurate fatigue. Gilamata means it tires you. I make a big point of this when I teach meditation retreats. Don't go pushing too hard, because you get fatigued and tired. Your body starts to ache and hurt. It's not the middle way. If you need to sleep, sleep. Don't go pushing through it. You get more tired, more exhausted. So at the retreat center, Jhana Grove, you see that it's this which makes me put things like en suites in all rooms, which don't have a fixed schedule, so that you don't fatigue yourself by having to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and not sleeping at night because you have to share a room with someone who snores. Keep your body healthy and energized, not fatigued. That is straight from the word of the Buddha. And not painful as well. So what Buddha said, I did 6 years of pain, it didn't work. What do people do now? No, I'm going to sit through the pain. I am stronger. My will can beat down the pain. That is ego self. It doesn't work. Without going to these extremes, the Buddha has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to wisdom, which leads to peace. Direct understanding, which means understanding for yourself, not believing what other people say, to enlightenment, to nibbana. It is the noble eightfold path. Right view, I changed a few of these words. Right motivation. We're going to go through these in due course, each one of these. Right motivation is where you're coming from, before your act. What motivates you to speak, do in this particular way? Right speech, right action, right livelihood. This is what we do. Right endeavor, instead of right effort. Effort, again, encourages people to try too hard. Right endeavor is much more wide. Right mindfulness, and lastly, right stillness. As you all know, that for so many years now, calling it concentration just misses the point and causes a lot of problems, when samadhi means stillness. This is a middle way awakened by the Buddha, awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, to wisdom, leads to peace, direct understanding, enlightenment, nirvana. The pursuits, this is from the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, Majjhima 139, the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the right way. And in particular here, the reason I put it, because this is the understanding of that middle way. Avoiding the pleasure just of five senses, not the sixth sense, the mind. So wherever you get things like inspiration, a really good Dhamma talk, or you see people being really kind, really generous, and it brings tears to your eyes, the beauty of people, and it gives you a pleasure of the mind. That, the Buddha was saying, encourage. The deep meditations, huge pleasures. Do not be afraid of those. Develop them. So when we say pleasures, the ones we should avoid are five sense pleasures, and we replace those with the joys of the mind, the sixth sense. It's an important point because sometimes people say, oh, pleasures of the mind, you're not supposed to have any pleasures at all. As a Buddhist. That's terrible. You mean you can't have any happiness in your spiritual life? Who would want to be a Buddhist if you can't have some happiness? That was, somebody said, was a definition of the Puritan brand of Christianity. People like Calvin, the people who went to the United States, the definition of Puritan spirituality is the fear that somewhere, someone is happy. Take that smile off your face. That's not Buddhism. Okay. So, this is, and one of the other great quotes, Dhammapada 273, 276. Put this one down as the path. This is, you know, the way to end suffering. Fourth Noble Truth. The Noble Eightfold Path is the best of all practices. This is the only path for purifying insight. There is no other. Follow it. Follow this path and you will discombobulate Mara. And that's one of my favorite words, discombobulate. It's not used that often, discombobulate. But I think that just the sound of the word will give you all the explanation you need. It means like to confuse. You know, so he doesn't know what's going on. So that's one of my favorite words, to discombobulate. So if you want to go home and show that you are increasing your command of the English language, discombobulate is one of those great words. Discombobulate Mara. But what is most important, this is the only path, and this is exactly what it says in Pali, only, maga, path, nati anyo, there's no other for the purifying of insight. I quote that because still, some people say that mindfulness is the only path, satipatthana is the only path, but it never says that. That is a very bad translation of the Pali. It doesn't say that at all. When it gets the only path, it's always the Eightfold Path. Always, always, many, many places. So listen, the end of dying has been reached. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma. Practice as you are instructed, by realizing for yourself in this very life, through direct understanding, you will soon enter upon the abide in the supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which people rightly go forth into monastic life. The end of the holy life. Now, you probably didn't notice one of the translations there. listen, the end of dying has been reached. Sometimes people translate that as the deathless. And as soon as you translate it like that, which is not accurate, it's the end of dying, no more dying, no more birth. But as soon as you say the deathless, then people say, ah, this is Buddhist heaven. The deathless, the unborn, the unconditioned. People get very excited. Because at last, you mean, after enlightenment, after the body vanishes, then I can exist somewhere. I can have what I said to the monks, the ultimate retirement home for you, where you can live happy ever after in the deathless. Where you can live enjoying your friends and everything without any suffering in the ground of all being. They've got so many different names for these things. It doesn't mean the deathless as a state. It just means the end of dying, that's all. So, people, sometimes when we use these words like nothing or nobody, people actually take these words and put meanings in them which they never deserve. There was a story in the commentaries of Anuruddha. Anuruddha was a cousin of the Buddha. He became enlightened, but when he was a young boy, he came from a rich family, and he had his lunch. We had his little cakes for his lunch from his mum. And instead of eating them, he was gambling with his friends on playing marbles. And he kept losing the cakes. So he sent his servant to go and get some more cakes. 3 times his servant went back home and brought him new cakes. But the 4th time when his servant went home, mum says, no cakes left. They're all gone. Finished. And because of the karma from his past life, that it was impossible for Anuruddha to want something and not get it. That he couldn't even hear the word, there aren't any, because of his karma. So, when the servant came back with an empty basket, the heavenly being said, oh, we've got to enforce the law of karma. They're just like, heavenly police people to make sure that karma works and it never gets broken. So what can we do? So they put in some deva cakes. This is stuff which the heavenly beings would eat. And they put some in the basket. So when the servant arrived to the little kid, Anuruddha, and he said, ah, have you got the cakes? And the servant said, nutty cakes. Nutty means there aren't any. Probably nutty cakes. And so Anuruddha looked in the basket, and there's the most delicious cakes you've ever eaten in your life. And he said, wow, my mum has been depriving me all these years. She's never let me have a nutty cake before. Nutty cakes are the best. When nutty means just the word that aren't any. And that's just the like. No, you say, the end of dying. The end of dying. That is a state. Instead of saying there aren't any cakes, no, there are cakes. They're called there aren't cakes. There aren't cakes is a special type of cake. Oh, that was also used by Lewis Carroll in Alice Through the Looking Glass, I think, where she eventually arrived at the square of the Red Queen. And what the Red Queen was always saying, off with her head, off with her head, taking all sorts of heads off. But she said, I'm waiting for my messenger, I'm waiting for my messenger. Did you see anyone on the road? He said, I saw nobody on the road. What good eyes you must have. It's difficult for me at my age to see somebody, but you can see nobody. Amazing. And soon the messenger arrived. And the messenger arrived and said, oh, I expected you she said, you're very slow, messenger. And the messenger said, madam, I'm so fast. Nobody walks faster than me. He said, exactly, because nobody arrived before you. And so just playing with the English language, nobody and nothing, making that into a something. And that's often what people do with these words, which mean the absence of stuff. It's not an unconditioned, it's the absence of all conditioning, the absence of will, the absence of stuff. It's the end of dying, not a state called undying. It's a nobody. No one's there. Not a special being called nobody. As you see on people's t-shirts. Nobody is perfect. I'm a nobody, therefore I'm perfect. That's very good logic. Anyway, right view. So this is the introduction to the Fourth Noble Truth. Now this is the Eightfold Path, the way. After my parinibbana, this is the Buddha talking, parinibbana is, pari means complete, all over, total, without remainder. Some will think that the Dharma has ended and you no longer have a teacher. This is wrong. After the Buddha's parinibbana, the Dharma and Vinaya will be your teacher. So this is actually where, and I mentioned this, the Dharma and Vinaya is your teacher, what we're having here. Sometimes that people go to a particular monk or nun and give them far too much authority. I tell lots of people, as a Buddhist, you take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Not in any guru. You don't take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and Ajahn Chah. Certainly not Buddha, Dharma, and Ajahn Brahm. Certainly not Buddha, Dharma, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. You take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. It's an important point. So you don't attach to one particular teacher.
What is the Sangha?
The Sangha is a whole group of people who've gone forth in the institution which grows and generates and nurtures just the great teachers of Buddhism. Suppose someone were to say, oh, this is great. Suppose someone were to say, friends, this is the Buddha's teachings, the Dhamma and the Vinaya, that I have heard myself from the Buddha. Then you should check this person's words with the Sutta and with the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that this person has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from a community of senior monks with distinguished teachers. Then you should check this person's words with the Sutta and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that it is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that this community has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Or someone were to say, friends, I heard this from many learned elders who uphold a tradition. Then you should check this person's word with the Sutta and the Vinaya again. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that these elder monks have wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Suppose someone to say, friends, I heard this from one learned elder. Then you should check this person's words with the Sutta and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that it is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that this learned elder has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. So with all these cases, this is called the four great standards which the Buddha laid down for making sure that the good teachings will always continue. So that if they say anything, the final authority must be the Sutta and also the Vinaya. Yes? It's not mentioned at all, the Abhidhamma. So even the Abhidhamma, you should check it with the Sutta and Vinaya. And if it doesn't agree, then you conclude it was wrongly understood. Exactly. The Abhidharma came much later than the time of the Buddha. I was unable to say that for many years simply because the power and the weight of tradition. Even when I go to Sri Lanka, I say that, and many of the Sri Lankan monks say, thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for saying that. We all know that, but we're too scared to say it. Because, you know, we get criticized. As a Western monk, you are quite free to actually to point out things which the tradition doesn't allow one to point out. Fear. And it's obvious the amount of evidence is great. If anyone really wants to investigate that, just go online and get the wonderful piece of research done by Ajahn Sujato and Ajahn Bhamali. I think it's called the Authenticity Project. Now, great little piece of work, finding ways to discover what the Buddha actually taught and what's been added afterwards. You know, from a very fair, objective, well-reasoned basis. Very nice piece of research. So it's even actually some stuff which is in the suttas. You can actually look at, this is very dodgy. You know, in other words, it's unlikely to be spoken by the Buddha. And there's ways you can find that out. So find out exactly what the Buddha taught. Yes, first of all, it was... John, you had something to say to you? Yeah, okay, great. Okay, down from the back there somewhere. No. Okay, Eddie, make it quick though, please, to the point. Ah. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if that's true. I would disagree with that personally, having read some of it. And it's, but anyhow, that being the case, if it matches what the Buddha says, fine. It doesn't. That's the problem. It's quite different than what the Buddha says. Yeah, it is. But I'll give you one case which is just so obvious. That in the Abhidhamma they say that the process of enlightenment, for the process of enlightenment that, you know, we actually chant this, there's people who are on the path to being a stream winner, and people attain stream winning. And in the Abhidhamma they say it's just a fraction of a second between those two events. But in the suttas they say it can be such a long distance apart, sometimes even years, between entering the path and getting the fruit. Oh yes, yeah, some things are useful, but the best is the suttas. This is our core. Yeah, okay, yeah. Anyway, we'll go on from that one. Wrong view. That is impermanence, vijnana. That is the permanent essence. Stable, eternal, not subject to change, the same forever and forever. And that's just one of the wrong views, of the 63 wrong views. And unfortunately, there's many people, even today, who actually say that in the West, in Thailand. They say the amitajitta, the deathless mind, or even the original citta. And this is directly against wrong view number 8. I remember just years and years ago when I was number 2 monk, and Ajahn Jacaro was the boss, and he wanted to publish an article, and I'd say, hey, you can't say that. He said, why not? I said, that's wrong view. It wasn't his article, it was somebody else's. And I just got it out, wrong view. He said, oh, crikey, you're right. So it got canned from the newsletter by a very famous monk. So there is such a thing as wrong view. Be careful, because that wrong view does... Why is it wrong view and right view? It is in the context, what will lead to liberation, to freedom? What will lead to sort of being entangled in the world? It's right and wrong in the context of the goal of liberation and freedom from the samsara. Only that is what makes it right and wrong in that particular context. So right view. What is right view? It is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way of practice, even the cessation of suffering. This is called right view. There's a whole heap of these right views coming now. But that's the core one, understanding the Four Noble Truths. And the good and the bad. What are the good and the bad, and what are their causes? Intentional killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, malicious gossip, harsh speech, useless talk, desire related to the five senses, ill will and wrong view, these are the bad. Why are they bad? What's wrong with sexual misconduct? A bit of gossip every now and again. What's wrong with that? Because it just leads to more entanglement in the world. It just leads to more cravings, more wantings, and so it also leads to a bigger sense of self. So it's harder to disappear. The more of a sense of self, ego, pride you have, the more difficult it is to vanish. And what is the cause of these bad things? Wanting, aversion and delusion. That's the cause of all bad stuff. When we want, we might want good things, but in order to achieve those good things, we do bad acts. What was it? Who was it who said it was? One of those. I think it was. Was it Alan something? The guy who was Steve Jobs or one of those big. No, not Turing. The actual saying was, it's only religion makes good people to do bad things. Who was that? Something Alan or something. But anyway, it's just so saying that sometimes that the wanting even to do good things and to do good for the world can sometimes make people do gross acts of badness, causing the bad. We want to do good things. In order to achieve that, we've got to get people out of the way. Kill people, cull all the people, or cull all the naughty people. So we want to do, we think that's the best way for the world. So be careful of wanting, because it can sometimes make good people do some terrible things. And aversion, obviously delusion as well. Refraining from intentionally killing living beings, stealing, sexual misconduct, from lying, malicious gossip, harsh speech, and from useless speech. Contentment, loving kindness, and right view, that's the good. And it's interesting here, the opposite of, you see, what's the bad, the wanting is contentment. The opposite of aversion is loving kindness. That's the good. And what's the cause of the good? Renunciation, compassion, and wisdom are the roots of the good. Amassing stuff is the roots of the bad. Letting go, renouncing, giving away is the roots of the good. Okay. I think actually from here, is there any more questions? Because I'm going to go to the right view regarding the five components of existence. When it goes to unprofitable questions, I'm going to stop on that one, because that's a whole series of arguments which need to be dealt with all together. So I'll just go to the next one, right view regarding the five components of existence. You view your body as impermanent, suffering and non-self. You regard experience, Vedana, as impermanent, suffering and non-self. You regard perception as impermanent, suffering and non-self. You regard will as impermanent, suffering and non-self, and you regard consciousnesses as impermanent, suffering and non-self. This is the right view. In fact, that's the right view of the stream winner. And if that is your view, clear and fully understood, then you can tell it's said to be a stream winner. You view your body as impermanent, suffering and non-self. It's amazing just how obvious that should be, but people still want to actually to find a cure for death. And they think that, well, that, you know, with a bit more advanced in biochemistry, that we can stop aging and maybe even come to a time when no one needs to die. The body, and because the body is not suffering, but you can actually cure the suffering of the body. I remember as a student seeing a vampire movie for the intelligent people. It was supposed to be the intelligent person's Dracula. And in that particular movie, now it wasn't like sex and violence. It was this vampire had already been alive for 400, 500 years. And he was torn, this dilemma, existential dilemma, that he was so bored, you know, another day of life, because living for eternity has its own suffering. Or should he allow himself to be lured out into the sunlight where the rays of the sun would cause him to die? And he was afraid of death, but he couldn't stand any more of eternity. And the whole movie was about this fight he had, and obviously in the end he allowed himself to be drawn out into the sunlight. He went there almost willingly. He couldn't stand eternity. It was just before they did Groundhog Day, which was similar but had such a stupid ending. Falling in love ended his repeating the cycle. And I thought, oh, can you do better than that? But up until that point, it was a good movie. But if your body was permanent, would you enjoy it? So movies like Groundhog Day, or that movie on Dracula, who had eternal life. You know, as a psychologist, Chris, you can understand that would be incredible torment. So impermanent, suffering and non-self, who wants to be permanent? Haven't you had enough? Experience, Vedana, is impermanent. It comes and goes. And the thing with Vedana, the experience, you can't control it. You can't have happiness without suffering. But it's nice to know you can't have suffering without happiness. So it doesn't matter how much you suffer, you always know it has to pass, it has to go. Even in a really, really, really... What was this simile story? It was a book by an Argentinian fellow during the time of the generals. He was a journalist, disappeared in the middle of the night, taken to an underground dungeon and tortured by the generals in Argentina at the time. And it was called, his book, Prisoner Without a Name, Soul Without a Number. And it's a harrowing book, but the point, or the passage in the book which really struck me, was that, you know, he's been tortured, and one day between torture sessions, his guards gave him a letter from his wife. And he wrote in the book that he told his wife, never ever try and contact me if I disappear. And when he read that letter, all his memories of the life before, family, happiness, joy, all flooded back. And it was that which made the torture just so unbearable. He'd almost, as much as you could, got used to it. It was his life. Months and months and months in his underground cells. But now he had this memory which he blocked out so he wouldn't suffer so much. He said it was just so painful. The contrast, the memory of happiness, made the pain so much worse. The good cop and the bad cop routine. You need the good cop to make the bad cop really hurt. You can't, of course.
showed some kindness.
Yeah.
And it hurt you. Yeah.
It did. I mean, that really hurts you. Because now you've got something to contrast it with. Over in Christianity, I remember reading this. I think it was St. Augustine. He said, when you go to heaven, if you've been a good Christian, believe in Jesus, one day a year, one day out of 365, you have to spend the day in hell. Otherwise, you wouldn't appreciate heaven. And there's a lot to be said for that. You know, if you're living in heaven all the time, you know, it's just be normal. You know, you wouldn't really understand, you wouldn't appreciate it. So that's what he said. You still have to go to hell if you go to heaven. And I suppose the same with hell. Maybe once a year you go to heaven. And that really must suck to know you're going to go back down there again next day. Ooh. So, vana is impermanent, suffering and non-self. So you can't have continual happiness. So the idea of a Christian heaven, we live happy and ever after, or any place we live happy ever after, is just irrational. You regard perception as impermanent. I love this one. You can't trust your perceptions. What's your favourite food? Next year, what's your favourite food? You think, oh, it's just delicious, it's beautiful. But actually, when you get it, it's usually nowhere near as good as you fantasised it to be. Perception is always untrustworthy. It promises what it promises you what it never delivers. And my obvious example is the perception of when you fall in love. You remember the time you fell in love and your partner was the most wonderful person in the whole world. Just so delightful. And those of you who've been through a separation or divorce, you think, why did I ever marry that bastard? It's the same person. The perception has changed. So be careful, you can't really trust perceptions sometimes. They're impermanent. They let you down. And you're out of control. And, the will is impermanent. Can you ever, like people sometimes say, have a goal in life. Sustain that. Keep on going. Some people commit to goals in life and it's amazing. Eventually they give up. How long can you actually sustain the will? It's not coming from you. So after a while, people give up. So that's one of the problems with will. It's impermanent. It doesn't belong to you. It's just a condition, that's all. And to will is to suffer. Have you ever meditated and you can't just be peaceful and still? Always thoughts, there is something coming up. Where's that coming from? It's the will. Never lets you sit still for a moment. Always on your case. Come on. Watch the breath. Come on. Get up. Come on. Close the door. Come on. Scratch my nose. The will is always telling you what to do. Never allows you to be peaceful. So the will is suffering. But you know, every now and again, maybe the will just disappears for a while. You know what that's called? Contentment. Have you ever noticed those times of contentment, just sitting having a cup of tea by yourself? You don't want anything. What's missing? Will. After a while, you start to notice that will, it masquerades as your friend. It offers that if you feed your will, it will bring you riches and success and money. Just get out there and work hard and you'll be famous. You'll be wealthy. You'll be well known. But it always lets you down. And lastly, consciousness is impermanent, suffering and non-self. Because when your consciousnesses start to vanish, you're still peaceful. Meditation. You've never had so much happiness before as when your five senses disappear. After a while you realize, hey, why are the deep meditations so happy? It's because five senses are gone. They were suffering. So So this is where you understand the nature of the five components of existence. When you understand the impermanent suffering and non-self, you don't want to sort of encourage them anymore. Bye-bye, five components of existence. Okay. Any questions, comments? Because that's all I'm going to do today. Unprofitable questions will come in a fortnight's time. Now I open up for profitable questions. Okay. Okay, yeah.
A little confusion about ghosts.
Ghosts?
Yeah. And people, for instance, I've got a friend and her husband passed away a few years ago. And a few times she said to me, "Oh, Harry knocked on the door last night, clear as anything." And I came downstairs, I opened the front door, and there was Harry, and she said, "What are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here." So he said, "No, I've come to see that you're okay."
Yeah.
And she said, "That was as clear as any." And she's told me a few things like that. So I think, is that mind made, which you have mentioned at times, mind made, or is it a ghost, as such as how we think of a ghost?
Look, I mean, it very easily could be mind made. But, you know, she can have a conversation and find out which one it is. See if that ghost can tell her things that she doesn't know. For example, she may have lost a ring or something. Ghosts are great for finding lost items. And, you know, if that happens, she said, "Well, it can't be mind made because I didn't know where that ring went to." Or even better, you know, we know always raising funds for something or other. She should ask Harry for the lottery numbers next week. Because ghosts, they're notoriously good at knowing what numbers are going to come up the next week. And it's not for her. I mean, if it's her church or something she goes to, raise a bit of funds for her church and get Harry can help. But, you know, there's a little 5% for the Buddhist Society would help. Okay. Where's the next question?
Ajahn, what is a Buddha?
What is a Buddha? Mm. Okay, what is a Buddha? I think you've been asked this question in one of your other talks. When the talk should begin. What is a Buddha? A Buddha is an enlightened being. It's the first in a whole cycle of enlightened beings. So the basically Buddhism, Dhamma, Four Noble Truths, meditation just fades out. Like everything else is impermanent. So people get doing other stuff, they forget all the teachings, it all disappears, like everything will disappear in one day. And then another being is born and becomes enlightened. And mostly because of what they were doing in their past life. I know I get into trouble like this, but the Buddha Gautama, our Buddha, you know, that he was a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha in a previous life, and quite likely in a very recent previous life. And imagine that you were a monk under a Buddha. Surely you would have got something. Surely you would have got at least a stream winner. You know, being a disciple right in front of a Buddha. So, did Jyotipala, his name was, when he became a monk under Kassapa the Buddha, did he actually get anything? Now, we also know that the Buddha Gautama, in his previous life, he came down from the Tusita realm. It also says in the suttas that once returners, they mostly go to the Tusita realm before they get reborn again in this life or their last life. We know the Buddha came from the Tusita realm. And according to the myth, that this more to this myth than I ever thought, the Buddha actually said, "This is my last life," as soon as he was born. And how could he have known that? If he was a once returner, he would have known that. There's no babies who can speak when they're first born. "This is my last life." So there's lots to be actually said that even Siddhartha Gautama was a once returner when he was born. But what happens to people like that? They just live an ordinary life, you know, a good life, you know, exceptional young men or young women if they're young women. good, but they don't know the Dhamma when they're 6 or 7 years of age. You forget that past life, like everyone forgets their past life, usually at the age of about 6 or 7. The new brain, the new life takes over, and then you have to re-experience it. So that was Siddhartha Gautama. Why did he sit under the rose apple tree and get a jhana? Where did that one come from? Previous life. Letting go, doing nothing, just killing time while his father was busy. There's so much seems to imply that he was a once returner. And then under the Bodhi tree, getting into the jhanas, first watch of the night, remembering his previous lives before he became enlightened. Remember his previous lives. And of course he would have remembered the life under the Kassapa the Buddha. Remember all those teachings. So was it really discovering those teachings or remembering them? So for me, I say there's once returners get reborn in a time there's no Buddhism around. And they become fully enlightened and they teach. And that's the next Buddha.
So what's a silent Buddha? What's their part in it?
Ah, the silent Buddha, they're once returners, they get reborn. They become enlightened, but no one asks them to teach.
So how does the stream of Dharma continue if that happens?
Oh, because there's so many once returners. Sooner or later another one will come along. So there's plenty out there. We can have a few who just are not asked. I know that's very controversial, but there's a lot to say for that. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, good, yeah. Well, look, and it's quite likely, like someone like Anne Frank, a reasonably good girl, people who seem to be prematurely die, you know, they die without having fully lived their life. They seem to get like presidents in their next life, getting reborn. And of course, sometimes they remember things which other people can't remember. And they have details which there's no way they could find that out. Quite likely. Okay, we've got some from overseas here. See what we have. We're supposed to finish off at 4:30, so if anyone needs to go, it's you don't offend me at all by leaving early. Jan in Norway. Buddha taught cessation of birth is the ultimate joy, but if there is no existing, there is no joy either. All is impermanent. So does nirvana end too? This was a question which was asked of Venerable Sariputta. Let's say that Buddha taught cessation of birth is ultimate joy, but if there is no existing, there is no joy either. How can you actually call that joy? And Sariputta said, it's just like when a person is sick. If you're sick in hospital, when the sickness is cured, when you're over, you feel so happy. Because the happiness is the ending of an affliction. It's understanding what happiness truly is. The ending of an affliction. And so, when all the afflictions vanish and cease, no more 5 khandhas, no more experience, an affliction has ended. That's why it qualifies as joy. That's in the suttas. From the USA, Evie in the USA. Is going on the path towards liberation another result of cause and effect, or is it deliberate effort by something other than will? It is a result of cause and effect, and the deliberate effort, the path towards liberation, is caused by other people. It's a brainwashing. It's in the Mahavedala Sutta. The cause for stream winning is yonasamanasikara, going to the source, going to the womb, going inside, the origin of stuff. It is actually includes the jhana practice. And the other of those two causes is paratagosa. Literally means the words of another. And that's a powerful teaching there. You need the words of another person who's enlightened, or at least as a stream winner, an Arya, in order for you to become a stream winner. They actually put that seed in. brainwashing. To become a Buddha, you need another Buddha there, somewhere, another teacher, to actually put that seed in. That's why the Buddha Gautama had to have some input somewhere else, not just himself. You can't do it yourself. It has to come from someone else. So, that seed which caused the avalanche of the Buddha becoming fully enlightened, that seed was planted by Kassapa the Buddha. So the result, the cause and effect, comes from the words of another enlightened being, another Aryan. Lastly, it's wishing to live, craving. Yes, that is craving. It's wishing to die, craving. That is craving too. So don't think, oh, wish to live is craving. I'm going to end craving and I'm going to end my wish to live. A lot of times, it's not the ending the wish to live, that's the wish to die. That's the vibhava dhanha, the craving to annihilate. So all wishing is craving. So just let go and just go for the ride and stop trying to control it. Stop trying to end your life early. Stop trying to extend it. Just let the cause and effects play out. Let go. That's the wish to live, craving. It is craving. The wish not to live is craving. Is that clear? Okay. Anyway, there we go. That's another sutta class. My translation here, pretty accurate. You can always ask someone like Ajahn Bhamali, Ajahn Sujato to check me out because they're also really, really top class Pali experts. And the next class will be in 2 weeks' time. So I'll be back, going off to Thailand on Wednesday, but back by next the weekend of, when is it? 23rd, 24th, 25th, roughly that weekend, we do the next bit of the Word of the Buddha. It should be online, so you can even check what's being said next week, next fortnight. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good.